We're having a conversation this morning. It's an October morning, the 24th of October, year 2008. It's a beautiful fall morning. It's Halloween. We're all excited to what's going to be happening here in the Oil City area in the next week or so. We are in the lobby of the Historic National Transit Building, and I have the pleasure this morning of talking with one of the oil region's most distinguished personalities. He probably wouldn't consider himself that, but we do. And that's why we've invited Mr. Clarence Bud Pelagi to be with us today. Mr. Pelagi has had a decade, a big part of five, six-decade career in life here in the Oil City area, and his professional life was as a journalist and as an editor with the Oil City Derrick, but he's done far more than that. We're asking Bud this morning to relate to us, those experiences he's had as a journalist, but also as a citizen, a longtime citizen who's lived his entire adult life here in this community, what he's observed over the years and how he's participated. So welcome. I've had the pleasure of speaking with Bud numerous times. It's really good to see you, Bud. You look great. As you were telling us, your avocado and orange juice breakfast is really helping you look good after all these years. Welcome. How are you doing this morning?
Very good, thank you.
To get this going, Bud, you're not originally from the oil region area, Venango County or Oil City. You actually were raised in Masontown. Is that correct?
That's right. I was born in Masontown and went. I was raised there until I went to into the Army.
And then afterwards, you went on to West Virginia.
Yeah, well, I was in the Army for 3.5 years. Then I came back, and I was going to go to University of Michigan for a business degree, but a business opportunity appeared, and I got in partnership in a restaurant. So I canceled my college path and went into business. I was in a restaurant business for 8 years, and the last 4 years I went to commuted to West Virginia University daily, every morning, and got a degree. And when I got the degree, I sold my half of the store and got into journalism.
Yeah. What was the name of the restaurant you had down there? Right?
Well, it was called the Savoy.
The Savoy.
Yeah. it was the a really successful business, and the family friend who picked this opportunity up and came down and talked me out of going to college and going to business with him. He was going to be the silent partner, and I was the active partner. So I did that, and not only did we have a restaurant, but we also sold jewelry, which was an odd combination. It was right after the war. Guys were coming home. They were buying gifts for their girlfriends, and girls were coming in buying costume jewelry. So we did pretty good for the first 4 years, and then everybody saw that we were doing good, and they started doing the same thing. So actually, business slipped a lot.
Okay. So, did you pick up a journalism degree, or was...
I didn't know it's odd if I want to go into this. I was in business, and I had friends who were in education, teachers, and one was a college professor down in Norfolk who would come up every summer to Masontown. And they just coaxed me to go back to school, and I just couldn't work it. So what they did, being teachers, they had their summers off, and they were going to Morgantown for master's degrees or fulfilling other educational requirements. One fellow was working on his doctorate in history, they talked to me about it. So they finally worked it this way. They were going up, and they needed transportation. They said, how about you just driving us off for a class, and then we'll come right back, and you'll be in time here at the restaurant, to take care of your noon hour lunch. So I said, okay, I'll just drive you up. And then he said, well, if you're going to drive us up, you might as well, get a course. So I did. I got interpretive speaking or something. I forgot what it was, just to take a course. Yeah. And I liked it. So that was first 6 weeks, second 6 weeks. I said, I'll just take two courses. And gradually, and I talked to the people with the possibility of my getting going through the system there, just going to school in the mornings because I had to be back at noon for the restaurant. Mm-hmm. And they were very lenient and very very nice to me, and they worked it out. I was taking some two-level, three-level courses in my freshman year. And I got my degree. I got a little bit more than I needed, but in 4.5 years.
That's great. All right, so what happened? Did you just decide I'm going to go work with some paper, or how was that career decision made, and how did you end up putting an application into the Derrick?
Well, I owe a lot to the director of journalism, who really I owe a lot to, Percy Reed. He said he had a formula for me. He said, you have to, when you get your degree, work 1 year for a good weekly, then 1 year at a good small daily to know how daily, then place yourself. He said, don't go aiming for a big job. Said, work in a weekly first for 1 year, and 1 year at a daily, and then place. Well, he got me a job in Elkton, Maryland, a good weekly, big weekly, mm-hmm. at big circulation. And I was there, I liked the place, and I was there a year and 3 months when he called me up on the phone. Mm. Hey, he goes, get out of there, he says. And I said, okay. Well, I didn't do it. I was there another 3 months. He called me again. So right on the spot, I resigned. I gave him my notice, 2-week notice, and told him I was going to quit. Had no job, but I was going to quit. So what did I do? I registered with the Pennsylvania Newspaper Association that I was looking for a job, gave him my credentials. And Joe Zaffron, who was managing editor of the Derrick, called me up and offered me a job. Well, I still had this. I didn't have the store then, no. But I asked a lot of the guys who I knew were fishermen and hunters, and they came up here. So I asked them, what about Oil City? Mm-hmm. And I can remember the statement. It's a great place to hunt and fish, mm-hmm. but you won't want to live there. Yeah. So I called up Joe Zaffron, and I said, sorry, I just can't take the job. Well, he waited a week or two, and he called me again and told me, hey, just come up on a Sunday. It was spring. Take a nice ride up, and we'll pay your way up, and let us talk to you. So I came up, and I missed a turn down in Franklin. I went to Cranberry, came down through the East End, and you don't know the East End. It was a ramshackle. It was just falling apart, practically. But it was a big area. Right. I drove through that, then I couldn't see anybody. I drove across the State Street Bridge, which is now the Veterans Bridge, and I looked at what was the Railroad Plaza, and it was a windy day, and I saw papers flying around, pigeons flying around. I went down Elm Street, which was like a cavern, because there were both buildings on both sides, and I said, oh, what a place. So I said, oh, this is it. So I turned around to go back, and I crossed the bridge again. At St. Stephen's, I saw a policeman. I said, where in the hell is the Derrick? He said, right down this street, just about a mile. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I'm here, I might as well go down and talk to him. So I went down and talked to them, and I accepted.
Wow. To Oil City, and Harry's great delight that you did. I don't think most folks realize that you were almost ready to go back to Masontown and the Savoy restaurant.
Not quite. I think 8 years of experience in a restaurant, mm-hmm. It was enough.
Okay.
I've often said if somebody would offer me the best restaurant around here free, uh-huh. and pay me a salary, I wouldn't take it.
All right, so we have the career change.
Yeah.
You're now a young journalist in a small town newspaper, and this was, as far as you're concerned professionally, just another step in your career as a journalist.
Yeah. Well, to myself, I said, well, I was in New Guinea I was in the Pacific for 3.5 years.
Yeah.
A lot of it in New Guinea. I said, hell, I can take Oil City for 1 year.
Okay. But it ended up all these years.
Yeah, so I'm stuck.
So what happened?
I'm very happy to be here.
You're very happy to be here.
One of the best accidental decisions I ever made. Well, yeah, really.
That's wonderful. So you stayed. You liked the Derrick. You married here. And on.
I started off as a reporter, a beat reporter covering City Hall. At that time, it was a very active period because they were in their throes of their first redevelopment period. Mm-hmm. Joe Barr was he at that time he was only chamber president, but he sort of guided the whole renewal program himself, and he later became a mayor. But so I got in on that ground floor, and they had their first master plan being put together at that time, and I worked very closely with them. I attended all the meetings of the different organization, planning commission, and their city council, school board, stuff like that.
You were good friends with Joe Barr.
Very good. Had a lot of respect for Joe Barr. Very undervalued person. I think he did a lot for this town. He sacrificed his life, actually, for this town.
He was kind of a legendary guy over time. I had the pleasure of meeting him when he was in his later years. You know, in his later years, he was having trouble. That every once in a while he'd still show that flash of humor and charm that he had. And I mean, he was a handsome guy, too, for folks who didn't know him. But yes, you guys really changed Oil City dramatically. And I know you were part of that group, and these were your friends. And it's to your credit and all those guys' credit that these things did come about. Joe was the first Secretary of Economic Development in the state of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, he was on the ground floor of city planning. Mm-hmm. There was no such thing as city planning, I don't think, at that time. And he harped on it. He spoke in different places. And I don't know, he developed a reputation in city planning. So when Governor Scranton set up his cabinet, Joe Barr was named the first Secretary of Community Development.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a story, and you may have been there covering it. You had to be. The railroad station was still in existence when you came here. And that's one right here down where Justice
Park
is.
Yeah, I know what you mean, the plaza, railroad plaza.
Right. Do you remember when it was Gavin, Congressman Gavin was down there, and they were to push a lever or something like that, and the building was to go up. Were you there that day when it went up in flames?
Oh, yeah.
Tell us.
That was the, this was one of the redevelopment programs to redo the plaza area. And I guess to get rid of there were two stations there. There was the main station, which was brick, and then to the right there, near the bridge, was the Erie station. And that was all wood. So to get rid of that in the quickest way possible, somebody said, we'll just burn it down. And they had the firemen ready and everything, but everybody else ready, you know, to make sure that nothing got out of hand. Well, it went up and it was spectacular. It was a spectacular thing, yeah.
Yeah, I understand that they say that Congressman Gavin, who was kind of a tall guy, or at least he had long legs, he was leading the pack running away from the conflagration when it went up in a big...
Well, I don't remember that, but I imagine he would. I mean, he'd been around, I know.
Okay.
Yeah.
So those were your younger days. And while we're still in your younger days, could you tell us a little bit about your relationship with the paper down there in Franklin?
Oh, well, that's a story that goes... way beyond. We just had a meeting on baseball here, and the key, one of the key things that came out of this thing was the rivalry between Oil City and Franklin. Now, in 1919, the editor of the Franklin paper wrote a book. He was very interested in baseball, and the book was titled, and it tells you the whole story, 50 Years of Baseball War Between Oil City and Franklin. 50 Years of Baseball War. Mm-hmm. Now, right after that came what we call the two-team league. The two towns were so competitive, trying to outdo each other, both as far as community pride and also the people who were betting big money. So they start importing big league players into their teams. Mm-hmm. And well, that's a long story, but I see 1919, October 1919, Franklin had six of its nine first stringers all from the big leagues, major leaguers. And the reason they got them, they paid them a lot more than the big leagues were paying them. In fact, there was one guy by the name of Ole O'Mara who was interviewed in Oakland by an Oakland paper years afterwards, who came here to play from the Brooklyn Dodgers, and he said when he came here, his salary was doubled when he came to play for the city. So, okay, that was a long history of rivalry in baseball, particularly. But when I came here, there was also a lot of rivalry, but everything, in a lot of areas, between the hospital, the airport, they were trying to decide where to spend some money on a new airport. Franklin needed repairs. They had a study made, and there was some people were in favor of improving Splaine Airport because, according to the study, the weather was more favorable. Anyhow, Franklin raised a big fuss, and so the money went down to Franklin. You know, the hospital rivalry, you know, it started way back with a birthing unit. Way back, they were going to have a joint birthing unit. It fell through. Merle Mitchum, who's a friend of mine, was on a committee at one time in the late 50s, to the possibility of establishing one hospital for both cities. They went so far as to take an option on land between both cities, down around Reno someplace. Mm-hmm. And that thing fell through because of the rivalry, who was going to be in charge, I guess. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, this kept up. Okay, so this rivalry existed down to the newspapers. Mm-hmm. And the Derrick was owned by a different family, and the Derrick. And it wasn't the owners so much that were competitive, but the news departments. We just fought tooth and nail that if you put a story in the News Herald, we wouldn't run it, mm-hmm. and vice versa. Mm-hmm. It was very, very competitive. Mm-hmm. And we just, Joe Zaffron, the editor of the Derrick, wouldn't speak to the editor down in Franklin. They just didn't hate each other. Mm-hmm. It was an intense competition. So it was just intense.
I've heard.
Yeah.
It had to be an interesting time to be in the newspaper business.
It was competitive, right? And it made for better papers, I think, in a way, because you really had to go out and try to beat the other paper.
Oh, the standards were very high for both of these papers, yeah. No question about it. And for relatively small communities, mm-hmm. these communities really enjoyed the benefit of top-notch newspapers for the time. And so that competition always brings out the best in people, no question about that. We'll be talking to one of the old News Herald folks, Carol Lee, commissioner here. Do you have any sweet words for Carol Lee prior to getting her?
Well, I'll tell you the truth. For many years, I wasn't very friendly to her. Uh-huh. I got to know her, and we're friends now. Right? But it took time to wear that off. Yeah. It was intense competition, you know. And, well, in fact, I don't know if this is true or not, but when the Derrick bought the News Herald, this is my guess, maybe I shouldn't even say it. The reason, normally when you buy a paper, you combine them. You know, you put two names together and you have one paper. And being so close, Oil City and Franklin, it would be very logical just to have one paper with one name serving both communities. Mm-hmm. But because of this rivalry, this community's spirit that exists in both papers, in both towns, mm-hmm. I think the Derrick, I'm assuming, the Derrick said, we better maintain Franklin their own paper. So although both papers are printed in the same building, the same news staff puts it out, mm-hmm. they have just the paginator is a little different. They're told to do, you know, feature Franklin stories. They have two editions. Mm-hmm. So they keep them separate to some degree. But that goes back to the rivalry.
And that's why that intense rivalry. Now the intense identification that both communities have and the pride they take in those papers. Those papers have their own dynamic. They do influence, there's no question, they influence life here, not just by covering what happens here, but also how they do it and that sort of thing. You, Bud, over many years have been a major player. I, as an historian, recall many of the articles or the papers at the time you may have been the managing editor for that covered the oil history around here. And But Derek always did an outstanding job during your time, and I know there's a couple guys particular who were particularly good reporters when it came to covering the oil story. Can you tell us a little bit about some of them, or do you recall some of those fellows?
They were involved in
the anniversary editions.
We had so many anniversaries coming up, so there were many occasions for to write stories. Some of the major reporters. Well, one major reporter, I think, was Jack Payne,
yes,
who did a lot of historical writing, and he had a big background in local history. His father, I think, was mayor at one time, and historical. Everybody took part. We had a newsroom that everyone was able to do anything. You know, a person on society. We called the society then. It's no longer there. People working on the society section would have to go out and cover meetings sometimes, mm-hmm, or even go out and take a photograph. So it was, you know, there was no delineation between duties like there is today.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the big things, you know, when I first came there, I think I forget the date, but the Venango County was celebrating its 100th anniversary, 150th. They had a big addition, so we all worked furiously on that. Then in 1971, we had the centennial edition for Oil City, for the Derrick, and also for the First Seneca Bank, and we had a great big edition there.
Mm-hmm.
I've probably seen that one.
Yes, I have. I have it at home.
Yeah, I worked on that a lot. It took me about a year and a half to work on that, and I spent many, many weekends and late hours working on that. Yeah.
And I can assure you, many of us who do history use that as the starting point, and I think you know that, but that was a tremendous work. I mean,
it was, you know, it was a... And one section, I'll have to admit, one section was done by our sports editor, who happened to be Henry Dalecki. So, you know, we're talking about who were involved in the covering history here. So it was, but yeah, that was our one of our big projects, as far as. But we had many occasions. You know, it was a time there were anniversaries coming one after the other with either a bank or a business or somebody, so we just kept... And every time we would write a story, people would come in and bring us pictures and give us more information. And my being busy, I didn't have time to do much with it. It maybe run a picture in the paper and then put it in a box and take it downstairs. Now, what I've been doing since I retired is going downstairs and retrieving all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they've given me an archives room down there,
mm-hmm,
which is, you know, I'm not part of the staff. They just, they find a room I can have it.
Mm-hmm.
And what I do now is go down and get those boxes, bring it up, and look through them and refile the stuff in files.
That's all part of kind of like your other life, and that is at least that I'm aware of, and that's the Heritage Society activity that you've been involved in, that all came out of your work when you were putting these anniversary editions together and accumulating this material. Could you tell us about the early days of the Heritage Society and who the prominent personalities were and how that all came about?
Yeah.
And just basically explain to our viewers just what that was.
Well, I'm going back to Joe Barr's administration, and he was intent on getting a managing director, a city manager.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess, I don't know, the council wouldn't approve it or something, or there was no legal status for it, so he hired a guy by the name of Ball Albertson, a very young guy, but very, very aggressive. And anyhow, a lot of things were going on in town. We were having one renewal project after the other. We're tearing down, you know, the Main Street. We were tearing down the plaza. We were tearing down Stephen Street. Lots of projects. So Bob Albertson, he said, we're losing so much. Well, what happened is, every time we were tearing these things down, the DAR would come in and complain about tearing some historic building down.
Yes.
And I guess Bob Albertson thought, well, one way to do this is to start a historical society. So he got Jack Payne, who I mentioned before, who did a lot of historical writing, myself and he, and we sat at the Holiday Inn one day, and we decided to organize the Heritage Society. And it was just like that. We called a meeting. He sent out letters, and we thought of a guy who ought to be good to head it, and that was Varnes Borland, who was working for Quaker State at the time. So he served as president, and that's how it got started. Just the three of us, but Bob Albertson, thought of that this was a good way to evaluate some of these historical projects.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I understand in the early days you had speakers who would take different sides of an issue and debate it. It was really quite an intellectual group, if you will.
Well, that was his idea. That was Bob Albertson's idea, that everything had two sides. Particularly, the one big issue was over on Main Street. There was at one time was a New York Central Station.
Mm-hmm.
It later was a feed store, and that's where President Grant came and debarked from the train.
Yes.
And the DAR were very adamant about saving that building, and they put up a big fuss. And so Bob Albertson, I don't know what we did. I think we had a program on it for and against it.
Uh-huh.
And you know, I mean, so that became the format for most of our programs. Now I did one on John Dewey. Now, John Dewey was sort of a controversial person with a lot of people, and so we had I was a pro, and we had another guy I forget his name, Worry something. He took the other side. Mm-hmm. So it was a sort of a debate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the core of the debate there was to establish a historical marker for John Dewey on Central Avenue, where the fire station is now,
mm-hmm.
Where he had taught.
Mm-hmm.
And the people against us said, why do we want to, you know, put a memorial up for a guy like that? Because he was quite liberal, had a reputation of being liberal. And so we jockeyed back and forth. And to go one step further on that point, I took it upon myself to apply to the Pennsylvania Historical Commission, Museum and Historical Commission, for a marker. So I was friends with Jim Stevenson in Titusville, who owned the paper up there,
mm-hmm.
and he was on the library, on the Museum and Library Commission in Harrisburg.
Mm-hmm.
And I also knew Jay Kepler Davis, who was a representative for Forest County, and he was on the Library Commission. So I talked to both those two gentlemen, and I asked them about the possibility of getting a marker. So he said, oh yeah, just write it up and send it in, gave me the address where to send it, and we'll get it through for you. So I did it. I wrote the letter or whatever it was that I had to do and submitted it. And I get a notice some time later, sorry, but your application for a marker for John Dewey has been turned down. And so I saw my two friends, and I said, what happened? Well, I said, we were outnumbered. They thought he was a communist, and they didn't want approve a marker.
Yeah.
So 10 years lapsed. You know, I forgot about it. Okay, that was the end of that. I'm sitting in my little office here at the Derrick one day, and I get a call from the Pennsylvania Museum and Historical Commission, and they tell me, point blank, hey, your application for a marker for John Dewey has been approved.
Is that right?
10 years later, without my even, you know, knowing anything about it.
Uh-huh.
So we did. We got a marker up there now.
Congratulations,
yeah.
John. Congratulations, John Dewey. Years went by, and you retired after serving some time as editor of the paper. Any comment on that time you served as editor that you just want to share with us before we get into your retirement years?
Gee, I don't know. It was a different kind of paper then. I mean, I got in when they had what they call hot type. Mm-hmm. You know, they had linotype machines.
Mm-hmm.
You would write a you would write a story, it would send to the shop, and they would convert it into lead type, and then it would go and do that. So I started with that system. Then later it was, it kept changing gradually with tape. You would write a story, and they would put it on tape. Then you would write stories on special paper, which they could feed it through a machine that would actually operate the linotypes automatically. So there was just a lot of changes. And then I think it came around 1971 when they converted to photo paper. What do they call it? I forgot. Anyhow, Coal type, yeah. And interesting enough, we were in the forefront of developing this system. It worked on it for about 2 years. They had people from different companies come in here, from a college, I forget what college, university, was involved in trying to convert a bulky letterpress into offset. Mm-hmm. The other system at that time was offset. It was either hot type or offset. Mm-hmm. Well, they worked on it, and what they developed was they got around the offset by, instead of printing, transferring the image onto a roller, which then put onto the paper, this was directly from the plate to the paper, and they called it direct lithography.
Oh, yes.
Dilitho. That was the name of it. Mm-hmm. And it really started here. We had people from Japan
to
come in to observe the system. Actually, it started here, the dilitho program. Oh. What it did, it made the paper keep its bulky presses.
Yes.
Otherwise, they would have had to buy new presses
for the new system. Right.
But anyhow, we were in the forefront of that.
Great.
Otherwise, if you highlight other things about the Derrick, let's see. Probably not. Nothing. Just a lot of addition. Our people were very involved in the city. Bob Rhodes was very involved both in the planning, and we have a lot of projects going on. The new hospital, new churches. There was always people in here guiding fund drives, and they one after the other. And there was a lot of involvement with people in our paper. E.P. Boyd was very involved, money-wise and time-wise. Bob Rhodes did a lot, and some other people. And I was more or less the delegated to publicize all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, I mean, now a lot of the reporters have a specific beat, but when I came here, I was more or less urged to cover everything. I went to board meetings, school board meetings, mm-hmm. even go to Franklin. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, the other big thing that happened in my period of time with the Derrick was the Lydia Dean trial. There was a big major trial here that brought in all kinds of media people. It was a soldier who married a Filipino girl in the Philippine Islands, brought her here. They lived up around Titusville someplace. And I guess he wasn't too loyal to her. They had a little baby. And I guess one night she had enough. She got a shotgun and while he was on the couch, shot him dead. So we had a murder trial, big murder trial. And it had really international repercussions because people in the Philippines sent a special attorney to defend this woman. Mm-hmm. I forget what paper in England would call us every night for a summary of the trial. Mm-hmm. And we had clippings from Japan, from all over, mm-hmm. because this poor little girl that came here with a soldier, and she's has a little girl, and now she's up on trial. So we had who was the attorney? Did a wonderful job. Anyhow, the bottom line is the verdict was not guilty.
Sure. She was acquitted.
Yeah, acquitted.
She was acquitted. Yes.
Yeah. Right. But that drew a lot of attention. The Derrick newsroom was converted into a sort of international newsroom. AP had machines down there sending pictures out.
Yeah. Imagine what that'd be like today. You'd have those big TV trucks with those satellite hookups, all those things.
Yeah. That would have been different.
Quite a story. Lydia Dean.
Lydia Dean Trail. She's still living. She went south, I think in Kentucky or Tennessee to live. She's probably still down there. Well, that was a really, obvious murder trial. But she got off.
When did you retire?
I was trying to think about that, I think this morning, if you should ask me that. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember. I think I've been retired for about 13, 14 years, maybe 15 years.
Okay.
So I have to go back. It's quite a while.
I've often wondered. I can never nail you down or anybody else to say when actually Bud retired. You've kind of been at it, and you never really did retire. He's still in the Derrick.
I'm still down there a lot. Uh-huh. I go through. I have my archives room is on the way on the far end. I have my own entrance. They don't see me unless I want to walk through them. Yeah, so I'm down there a lot. Yeah, so.
Well, the Heritage Society it continued to exist, not always active. Mrs. Harvey was principal. Person involved in that. Could you tell us a little bit about her role, please?
Right. As you said before, it was a unique way we presented programs. We had pros and cons, mm-hmm. and we had good speakers. Mm-hmm. We would hold our meetings. Well, I don't know if there were annual meetings or more often, but in the Holiday Inn. And we would get a room full of people, mm-hmm. 100 or more, mm-hmm. And we had key speakers. We had I can't think of his name now, but he was a bat boy for the two-team link, and he became an oil man in Chicago. He came to talk to us, and the Heritage Society kept going pretty good for a while until 1971, when Varnsborn decided not to be president anymore, and then the attendance to the meetings slipped down a lot, and I remember the time we elected Barb Harvey, Mrs. Joseph Harvey, as president, and for one reason or the other, the club just melted away, mm-hmm. and she maintained her position, and she became a little ill, and so she did a lot of her work at home, and still did the correspondence. If ever there was a question about history that would come to the library or to the Derrick, they would refer it to her, mm-hmm. and she would handle it.
I never had the pleasure of meeting her. I understand she was kind of legendary, beautiful woman.
Yeah.
That's what they tell me. She became the repository for so many of the sources of material that we value today as basic history for the oil industry in Oil City. In time, much of that would go to the new Barbara Harvey library, mm-hmm. Section at the Benango campus. Isn't that right? Okay. And tell us a little bit about that so this can get on the historical record for people in the future, how that transpired, if you remember.
The Bob Harvey stuff?
Yeah, right.
Okay. Well, yeah. Well, Joe Harvey, and I know Joe Harvey quite well, and he was wondering what to do. There's two aspects of this. One was all the stuff that Barb Harvey had collected up in her house, historical stuff, mm-hmm. what to do. So he did one time bring a mass of it down to the Heritage Room upstairs at the library. So we talked about it, and he didn't tell me, but I offered to disseminate this stuff for him, because I said some should go to Drake Museum, some maybe to other places, So as a result of that, he brought everything down to me, and I had Barb Zoli come down from the Drake well. She had first choice, whatever she wanted, she took it. Some went Dr. Franklin. There was some Miller stuff, which I thought would be more appropriate down there. So that's the way disseminated that. But then, as far as the Barb Harvey thing, well, that's a separate item. I don't know how that got around. I know he talked to me about doing something for Barb, but I never knew how it got to that point.
Okay, well, hopefully he'll be able to tell us here.
Okay, good.
One of our interviews.
Oh, good.
Now, I have to ask you, as we're kind of beginning to get to the end of this here, but that you've been here now 5-6 decades. You said you revealed to us, well, you came here, you tried for a year. Of course, you've been here much longer than a year. When you first came here, your first visit to town didn't look too good, things of this nature. Why don't you kind of tell us what you see today, after all that time, about Oil City, the good and the bad? What's changed? What's good? What could be better? Those sorts of things.
Well, you know, the biggest change was, I'd say the culture, maybe, or the mix of people. Because when I came here, like in 1955, and for many years afterwards, there was a big number of people in the middle management area. Mm-hmm. We had banks, Pennzoil, Oilwell, J&L, and these are people in sort of middle management who were very active in the community. In fact, Joe Barr made it a point to have a big advisory committee of about 50 people, of all these people. And they were very active, and they were in school boards. They were on a lot of things in the city. And what has happened is these plants, these banks, don't have that middle management group here anymore. And what you have is a different mix of people. So the big thing that's changed is that core of middle management people who were either by their own instinct or desires to be active in the community, or many times they were urged by their companies to get involved. Mm-hmm. I know some companies wanted their men on the boards. Mm-hmm. I know First Seneca Bank, Oilwell, they all tried to, excuse me, saw a fly there.
A little nap. Yes, our friend who's been keeping us company.
Yeah, well, where was I?
The companies that required their people to be on some
and that did a lot of good, and you don't have that. And the people, as a result, the school board mix in the city, all the boards had, I would say, I hate to say that, but a more dedicated, higher class of people. Mm-hmm. More doers.
More professional.
More doers. They were dedicated, you know, to doers. Yeah. And I see that missing. And that's a big change. We don't have that group of people. The other thing is, well, the whole town has changed, you know, physically. And you wouldn't recognize if you were to put 1955 against today.
Well, today you have to admit, Oil City is a much better looking town than it was in 1955, don't you think? Or maybe you don't.
Well, yeah, it's a little bit, you know what I've been saying? You're on city council, and I hate to say this, but I think there's a time now for another big redevelopment push, urban renewal, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. because you have a lot of deterioration in this town.
Yeah, the blight.
Aging is causing that, yeah. and the mix of people you're getting in here is causing, and I think there are areas I look around, but wouldn't it be nice to eliminate that block and put an apartment building for not low class, but middle income people.
Right.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yes,
I often think about that, and I hate to identify the places where I see that possibility, but it's better than it was 1955. Yes, it's not as, but there are different needs now. I think there's needs for housing for people of middle income. And I know a lot of my friends who are as old as I am, they would like to get out of their big house, but they don't want to go into a low house or one of these small apartments in an individual house, something like Meadville has or something like that. But it's a great place, and I, even this morning when I looked out and saw all the sky p- pink and blue. Well, it was beautiful. I said, well, no better place in the world to be than right here.
You're right. I agree with you. Exactly. Are there any parting comments, closing comments you would like to share with... Remember now, we're talking to the world and we're talking to generations to come.
Well, I don't know. I guess the thing is, for I like to urge people to get involved in their community. The big thing that I would like to see done in this town, if you want to even improve it more than it is now, is to make the town look more attractive. And the one thing is cleanliness and orderliness. Now, every time I walk into Walmart or even now in these other grocery stores, one of the prime things is to keep their place neat. Mm-hmm. You look at the floor, it's neat and clean. Mm-hmm. You look at the shelves, they have people stacking them. So that's a big thing that they're pressing on the business side, mm-hmm. is to make it attractive and pleasant when you walk in. So I would like Oil City to be that way. If I walk down the street, I hate to see stuff on the side. I park my car in a parking lot, I hate to see bottles and papers strewn all over the place.
Yes.
Or stuff like that. If there was only some way, you know, to keep the city clean and neat, I think that'd be a big attraction. All because right. When people go to Singapore, what do they talk about? How neat and clean it is.
They certainly do. And it is. It really is. We have lessons to learn from this.
Yeah.
Well, I've learned a lot from you in my years here in Oil City, and I think others have too. It's you have been a credit to your generation. You've been a credit to this community. You are a man that will be always well thought of. I wish you many more good years of those avocado orange juice breakfasts. And maybe we'll all learn a lesson on long and happy life from you. And with that, I'd like to just say thank you, Bud. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Good to see you.
Yeah.
Nina, you want to look at your camera and just kind of do a little outro?
In this session, this is the first of our ongoing conversations with individuals in this area who've made an impact, had a great impact, because of not only what they did, but the kind of lives that they've lived in this region, that we were able to meet in the National Transit Building itself, something that means a great deal to the community, is symbolic in itself. It's just something we're going to continue to do. It's a pleasure to look forward to.
Okay. Now, we're sitting at about 48 minutes. If you can think of another question that we can edit in the middle, that would work.
Hey, could I go to the men's room?
You certainly could. Go ahead and stop taping
them. Over the years, that sort of thing. Could you kind of like get into that, get your mind into that, and recall for all of us who your neighbors were?
Let's wait until the siren goes.
Oh, yeah. I'm just asking, this isn't for tape. Right now, we're just talking.
Okay.
You want to do something like that?
Okay, this is off. Some of the people on that street, I'm trying to think how many mayors we had on that street, I think.
Okay, well, don't give it all to us.
No.
I want you to do it
fresh. I'm thinking now.
Okay, well, you'd be comfortable doing that?
We can
just think and fit that in. I'll say something about, you live in that really nice home you have on Kyle Avenue, and that's famed for being the...
Some of the people on the street.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay,
ready? All right. But you live and have for some time in that beautiful home of yours up on Kyle Avenue. I've actually stopped and asked you to sign my petitions a couple of times, but I find out you're not the same party necessarily, but that's all right. Kyle Avenue is famous for being the street of Oil City mayors and the chief executive officers of some of our oil companies. Who were some of your neighbors like that, and who do you remember as the fellows who lived on that street?
Well, first, maybe I'll try to recall some of the mayors, because that's one thing I point out about a lot of time to people at the city of mayors. We had Joe Barr, lived at the bottom. We had, Richard Van Kirk. We had Ted Williams. We had on the top of the street, Wayne Blyward and Jack Payne.
Yeah.
That I can remember.
Yeah.
Then among other people on the street, some of the people I don't even know, because it's a big house at, near the bottom. I don't know if it was a Crawford house.
That was a Quaker State CEO house, the big
brick
yes,
one,
right,
was that?
Right,
see,
right.
I didn't know that. Yeah. But we had Contino, Joe Contino, mm-hmm. who was
National
president
Transit.
Of National Transit, lived on the street there. We had Stu McCullough, who was a postmaster. We had some of the business people like McCarthy's, who owned the McCarthy Garage. There are some doctors on the street. It's been a big change on the street since I've been here. I know I've been there since 1971, so
mm-hmm.
I've been there quite a while. But some of my neighbors don't even know now, to tell you the truth.
Wow. That's to be expected. You know,
yeah.
Powell Avenue, physically, it only existed at the bottom two blocks. Up higher, that's all fill.
Right.
That was put in there, what, about 1910? You
yeah.
probably may
have. We found that out when we wanted to put stabilize our garage. It was leaning a little bit, so we had Dave Schreckengoss come in, and he lifted the garage up to put the footers around it. And boy, they complained. It was all dirt, stones, rubbish. Mm-hmm. It was terrible. So they must have had all kinds of fill in that
mm-hmm.
place.
Mm-hmm.
You look at it, you wouldn't think of it, but by looking at it. But it was almost remade, that street. I guess, and also up the street, they had problems with subsidence of soil.
Yes.
Because there was an underground stream.
And still is. And still is.
Is it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. If you recall, about 5 years ago, the city put some sort of a plastic liner in there.
Yeah, yeah.
Very expensive undertaking. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were sinkholes.
Sinkholes, yeah, right.
That's
right. So, yeah.
Folks in Kyle Avenue are very proud of their address. They'll tell you, I live on Kyle, even today.
Is that right?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, they will.
Right.
Up in the library, second floor of the Oil City Library, there's some publications speaking to Kyle Avenue and how proud they were.
I don't know all the people, actually. You probably know more of the oil people there besides Contino that was on that street.
The names aren't coming to mind right now, but you're right. It was where the not only the CEOs of Quaker State and sometimes Pennzoil and South Penn Oil,
yeah.
they were all
yeah.
there, but also those first-level managers right below them,
mm-hmm.
they had a lot of their homes there.
And also the judge, what's his name, lived on the corner of Third and Kyle.
McCracken.
Judge McCracken lived there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we had.
And then that was the road, the street you took to go up to the Circle.
The Circle. Yeah.
Which at the time was, they live up in the Circle, which meant something.
Which at one time was a racetrack.
Right.
In fact, Tom Mix, I understand, performed up there at one time.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
That home, you didn't build that home. You're
no, no. It was owned by an oil man, Burgess.
Mm-hmm.
He was in one of the pipeline companies.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think two houses up from me was another pipeline executive. I forget where Stu McCullough eventually lived.
Well, you know, this is interesting in itself. You're bringing out something. The homes in the Oil City area, both sides of the river, they were all connected to oil people. In the years that they changed hands, it was always either the oil men built it or they moved into it, that sort of thing. We can't get away from our oil history here.
Yet they're not big houses like you find other places where the oil people really built big houses. Yeah. Yeah, well, Van Kirk, his wife, Mary Van Kirk, lived on Cottle Avenue on the left-hand side. Right below his house was his sister-in-law's house. And she was granddaughter, or I guess a granddaughter, of one of the three founders of Pennzoil, Cesur. Forget who that was, but anyhow.
Lou Walls.
Lou Walls. Yeah.
W-A-L-Z, I believe.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was oil connected too, because...
Sure. They were all there.
Yeah. You know?
So... the street's still Grand Street. Are you moving? Is your house for sale?
My house?
Yes.
Hey, I'm cleaning it out, getting ready.
I thought so.
Trying to get rid of all the stuff.
So anybody's interested in Pennzoil City.
No, we have an offer. Annual yard sale. The whole street's, you know, had a yard sale. Uh-huh. So I've been getting rid of a lot of stuff that way, giving my nieces and nephews stuff.
When's the yard sale? This weekend?
No.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm down to books now, mostly. Uh-huh. A great collection of books. I don't know what to do with them.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that comment.
Yeah.
Moving on.
Yeah.
Now, why don't you ask one thing about some of the positive things in Old City, and we'll keep that as a final question.
All right. This is just preliminary. I asked at the end of the...
We're recording.
But because of your years around here, I'd be very interested, I'm sure our audience would too, what do you see that is... good, that are positives about not only Oil City per se, but the region, Venango County, that sort of thing, that you feel good about, and as you move on, you'll feel good that these things have happened.
Yeah, well, one reason I'm glad to be here is, even though I'm not a hunter nor a fisherman, which would be a great place to be like paradise. Yeah, I still think it's great. I mean, the outdoors. I can remember times. Well, I remember times like when we used to go up to Pithole area every Saturday and have a cookout. Mm-hmm. You know, you travel within 5 minutes. You can get to some place where you'd like to be. You know, whether it's on the river, the canoe, or I don't fish, but just to look at the river. Sometimes I just love walking across the bridge. Mm-hmm. And looking at the river. And I said, I was in Europe a couple of times in Italy, and I would marvel to see, you know, walk a bridge and see that. And then I walk across the Veterans Bridge. I said, this is 100 times better and nicer. I should appreciate this. I don't have to go to Italy. I don't have to go to someplace else to see a sight, you know? And the hills, is a variety in the hills, the topography. Basically, one thing I tell people, and I've told this down when I was down in Naples to the guy who was in charge of a historical center, and I think he's the one that told me about it. I was telling him all that we have here, and he said, now we have to hype everything we put in here. We have to hype it up. He said, you have it naturally. He said, your place has a soul.
Yeah.
And I keep thinking about that this place has a soul. It's more than the buildings, you know, the stores. This is a soul because it goes way back. The history is part of the soul. The topography is part of the soul. And it's even the climate. Mm-hmm. The most beautiful fall we ever had. Mm-hmm. I think recently I used to marvel at it. I said, no place in the world would it be nicer than this to be right now.
Right.
So it's a accumulation of a lot of things, which is, you know, physical, historical, and the people. The people are so friendly. I don't spend much time at home. I'm always out. For breakfast, I go to a coffee shop. I always eat out. Lunch, eat out. I don't cook much at home. If I maybe open the can, the people are friendly. I go out to meet people, and it's a pastime, mm-hmm. and the people are friendly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I happen to agree with you 100%. I know that years ago, my family used to come up here on weekends just to see the place. My dad worked here in the 30s, and he just wanted to come back to enjoy the hills, the river. He loved the ice. I have to tell you, the ice on the Allegheny in wintertime. just a wonderful place to be, and you can't take that away from the Oil City area. That's just the way it is.
Yeah, and the whole water is great. I have to tell you this story. My father would lived in Mason Town. I would visit him occasionally, about once a month. And every time I'd go down, I'd bring 2 gallons of our water. Because it was so much better to make coffee with that
water. Best water in the
world.
Yeah, best water.
Right. There's another plus. You know, you could probably, the more you think, the more you could find good about this place. It really is. And I think that the only thing, just if we could some way make it more inviting, cleanliness, orderliness. Mm-hmm. You don't have to have any big industries here. It could become a great place to live. I know people would like to come back and live here.
Well, let's hope in the next decade or two that actually becomes reality. And again, thank you, Bud. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, excellent. Good job.
It's the perfect timing.
Yeah.